We know that group homes, the cost continues to escalate, so it's a huge cost pressure on the NDIS. But in many respects, it remains the default option for people with high support needs. And I think there's many reasons for that. I think there's a lack of awareness about alternatives. So people don't know, and families don't know, that there's another way for people to live with disability. I think there's been weak leadership from the NDIA. They haven't promoted alternative options.
We believe that, unlike group homes, you know, people are safer in these types of arrangements because they're not inherently safer with a paid support worker with them 24/7. And we believe that that understanding, the business as usual, that a paid support worker is better, must change.
Hi, I'm Dr. George Tomopoulos, and welcome to Visual and Necessary, Australia's permanent podcast series on the National Disability Insurance Scheme, brought to you by the Summer Foundation. I'm coming to you from Wurundjeri land and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. But before we go any further, please do me a favour and hit the like button, make sure you subscribe to the channel and select the notification bell so you can be notified of future episodes. In this episode, we ask why, after 10 years of the NDIS, so many of us are still forced to live in group homes, and what needs to change so that we can have individualised living arrangements that provide real choice over where we live, who we live with, and how we are supported. I'm joined by Anna Burke and Jess Walker from the Summer Foundation to get some answers from a new report entitled Moving Out and Moving On. Check it out. Hi, Jess and Anna. Welcome to the show.
Hi,
George.
Thanks for having us. Great to have you on. Today we're talking about what we often talk about at the Summer Foundation, and that's why are so many people with disabilities forced to live in group homes under the NDIS, and what's it going to take to move away from group home living. So before we get into it, how about we start with some introductions? I'll start with you, Jess.
So my name's Jess Walker and I'm the head of policy, communications and systems change at Summer Foundation.
Anna.
Hi, George. I'm Anna Burke and I'm the manager of policy and government relations here at the Summer Foundation.
Thanks, Anna and Jess. How about we start with a really important question? I'll start with you, Jess. Why do group homes dominate in the NDIS? And I know that you're really passionate about the issue. In fact, I know it's the first issue that you chose to tackle in your role here. So tell us why.
So I've been involved in the NDIS since its inception, really since the Productivity Commission was first engaged by the government to do an inquiry into disability care. So I've got a deep commitment to the scheme over many, many years, and it's great to be at Summer, where, you know, one of our main objectives is how we build different options for people to live, which are outside of group homes. We've still got 40,000 people with high support needs, and many of those people are still living in group homes. So not much has changed for them since the NDIS was introduced. We've had a Royal Commission that's shown that there's, terrible, harrowing stories from the Royal Commission about what occurs in group homes. We know that group homes, the cost continues to escalate, so it's a huge cost pressure on the NDIS. But in many respects, it remains the default option for people with high support needs. And I think there's many reasons for that. I think there's a lack of awareness about alternatives. So people don't know, and families don't know, that there's another way for people to live with disability. I think there's been weak leadership from the NDIA. They haven't promoted alternative options. I think there's outdated pricing. So they did introduce individualised living options to try and grow these alternative arrangements, but they haven't indexed it. I think there's been a lack of a clarity from the NDIA about how to set up and claim for these alternatives. So in my view, the NDIA needs to make a much more active role in stewarding the market in this respect, and they need to act now so that we can grow further housing and living options that aren't just in group homes.
You were at the agency for a long time, I think almost 10 years, and you're in a very senior role. I have to ask, why didn't you fix it when you were there?
Well, we did a lot of work on housing and living. We did work on the housing and living framework, which I'm very hopeful that the government is about to release. And that really is about how we support individualised living arrangements. And it talks about having specialist navigators to help people navigate housing and living, talks about having a flexible budget so people can use that to live the way that they'd like to live. So I'm hopeful that big piece of work that we co-designed over many years will be released soon. And I think, you know, there has been some inroads with the passage of the legislation, which will enable people to have a flexible budget or a more flexible budget following an assessment. So that too should help people to use their budget to meet their needs, their housing and living needs, in a way that works for them.
There's a lot of developments coming up. Looking forward to hearing more on this podcast, of course, in coming months. Thanks, Jess. Now we know that there is a better way. Let's take a look at two young guys from Melbourne who are a great example of what's possible.
Opening slide, graphic, text, title. Homeshare, Bar and Matt. Bar, watching TV as Matt arrives home from work.
Hey, Bo, how you doing?
What's happening?
How's your day been?
Good.
That's good. You see the T's win on the weekend?
God, man.
Ba and Matt preparing and eating dinner. Ba.
I was living in an institution which was not good, which should never exist, because those places are not meant for people like me, or for anyone else for that matter.
Sigal, Bar's mother.
We decided to assist Bar to live in his own home when we understood that the group home is not working and he can't live the life that he wanted.
Matt.
So Bar and I met at a dinner party and we got talking about our lives, and he shared with me that he was looking for a housemate. Yeah, living with Bar is great. We have a lot of common interests that we share, largely around sports, current affairs, or movies.
Having more independence and doing whatever I want and basically having my freedom that I didn't really get to have before.
What are some of the benefits? I mean, obviously living with Bai, he's incredibly social and positive. It's amazing how positive he is, actually. So coming home, seeing him in an upbeat spirit is incredibly rewarding.
Vision of Bar greeting Matt when he arrives home from work.
I also have a lot of my own time that I need. I don't feel that I have a whole lot of obligation. Like I have my weekends where I'm free to do whatever I want. And a lot of that is spending time with Bar, whether that be watching TV or going out, doing things. But in the main, it would be like living in no other share. That's the exact same as living in any other share house.
So the housemate provides some support with dinners twice a week, companionship when he's home and coming and going, you know, those little things. Also help in managing the house itself, you know, taking out the bins on a bin day. I mean, they live together, so those things are shared. When you choose the people, find the common interest. It's really important.
My advice to anyone looking to get involved in the housemate arrangement is to definitely get involved. It's been incredibly rewarding. I made a friend out of it, and it hasn't impeded my day-to-day life at all. In fact, it's made it better.
I'm happy that I actually have friends who love me and care and don't just put me away and think that I'm not as important as I should have been many years ago.
What a great story. Thank you to Bar and Matt, and to the people at the London Rabbits. And the Song Foundation has just released a report on individualized living arrangements, like what we've just seen, as alternatives to group homes. In your research, you came across a lot of stories like this. What surprised you the most when doing that research?
Yeah, thanks, George, and thanks so much for having me on the show. It's really great to come and speak with you about the different ways that people want to live, and also to be able to share stories like Bar that we've just seen. So what Bar has shown you is that there are different ways to live, and in our report we looked into some of those arrangements. So Jess has talked about these as individualised living arrangements, and what we know from what people tell us is that life is better when it's shared, and Bar and his housemate are an example of that. From our work that we did with providers, we know that these arrangements can be safer and also cheaper for government whilst really giving better outcomes for people with disability. We know that there are about 520 of these arrangements across the country supported by organisations, and then there's also a lot more where people with disability are managing the arrangements themselves. And so what we've seen is some really great examples across the country. We've got some really strong work in WA, but we know that we're being held back here. We're being held back by an outdated pricing structure and people not knowing that individualised living arrangements are an option for them. And so what I was really surprised about was the extent to which we're being held back. So, for example, in the UK and Canada, these arrangements are common. There are more than 10,000 people in the UK supported through host or home share type arrangements, and we really need to create the environment for these arrangements to grow in Australia and make sure that people with disability know that they're an option.
You mentioned cost drivers there. I'm really interested in that. The Sun Foundation commissioned an independent economist didn't to look at the cost drivers of group homes and supporting independent living and also at the alternatives and comparing them. What did you find?
Yeah, so we did commission an independent economist to kind of have a look at both cost drivers in SIL and then also to look at how that compares to individualised living arrangements. And what we've found is that the government could save $260 million over 5 years if 500 more people chose to live in individualised living arrangements rather than in group homes each year. And what we also found is that SIL prices have jumped by 28% over the last 5 years, and SIL providers are still struggling. So I think they're struggling for a number of reasons, and one of those is about the increasing vacancy rates that they're kind of challenged with at the moment. People are voting with their feet. People want something different than living in group homes, and we're really seeing that come to pass. So I think there are better alternatives, and individualised living arrangements are just one option that should be available to people. And I think more than just the funding amount or more than just the savings, we have to also focus on kind of the better outcomes that are delivered through individualised living arrangements. So what we know is that people have a greater sense of belonging and connection. They have more say over their life, and they often live in safer and more supportive homes. So that's why we've done this report, because we really want to drive an increase in these options being available to more people with disability.
And for all of those economists who are listening, what is it that makes group homes so expensive, and why is an individualised approach not cost effective?
Well, I think one of the unintended consequences that we've seen with the NDIS is a real increase in paid support workers hours. and probably a decrease in informal support and more community-based supports. And so this has led to, you know, a less inclusion in the community, which is completely contrary to what the NDIS was set up to do. ILAs use what we call semi-formal support. And so with the live-in supporter that supports these arrangements, they help with companionship, they help the person with disability maybe getting ready for the day, cooking, they're there overnight. And so in a way that makes them cheaper than SIL because you're not having to pay for 24/7 hours of rostered support. I think the other issue is that group homes can often be staffed on a 24/7 roster, and this may or may not be needed for all participants in the house. So this can really drive up the costs in SIL as well.
I'm thinking about parents who might be listening, and they often feel like group home, yeah, there's 24/7 support, there's, you know, paid staff there all the time. Might think that it's a safer option, even though we know that the evidence is that they're quite unsafe. And what do you say to parents who are worried that these options might not be safe? Or what would you say to address their concerns around safety?
Yeah, George, the first thing I'd say is you completely understand that feeling from a family member about, you know, what's life going to be like when their family member moves out of the family home, you know. And what we know is that when we talk to providers, there were a lot of people that did use an ILA as their first experience of moving out of the family home. And we heard that in these arrangements, people thrive, and they thrive because of the relationship-based nature of these arrangements. Just talked about the importance before of those relationships, and these relationships go right through from the provider working with the person to understand how they want to live and design that arrangement, to the careful matching that providers do with a housemate or a host in these arrangements to make sure that there's a good fit for everyone who's living together, as well as the sharing of lives that the person with disability has with their host and housemate. There's a very deliberate emphasis in these arrangements that this is about sharing. This is about inviting each other into our lives. And so these arrangements do really draw on what we call natural or informal supports, but they are also within a structure. So providers put a lot of effort into the matching. They also do monitoring as the arrangements go along to make sure that everything's working for everybody, and they can be there to problem solve and troubleshoot if there's anything that needs addressing in the relationship between the host and their housemate. And we believe that, unlike group homes, you know, people are safer in these types of arrangements because they're not inherently safer with a paid support worker with them 24/7. And we believe that understanding, the business of usual, that a paid support worker is better, must change.
Yeah, and I think it's critical in these situations that the person is sharing and living with someone that they actually want to live with, that they have a connection with, that they like, that they get along with, because that is going to be someone that cares about them, that looks out for them when they're not feeling well, or that, you know, is going to, like we do in our friendships, we tend to look after each other.
Absolutely, George. And, you know, what we saw from some of the snippet of Bar and what we heard from people is that, you know, you develop a genuine relationship of care and trust. You care for the person and you look out for each other. And we all know that the more people we have who are voluntarily part of our lives, the more likelihood that somebody is going to, you know, say something if something happens to us, as you say, if we're sick or something else happens and we need help. And in this environment, there's someone there for us who is looking out for us every day.
Yeah, so important. I'm also thinking about that common view that people who have an individualized arrangement, that they're the people with the rich parents that can buy them a house, or, you know, the parents like doing all the work to set it up. And they just think that it's not for the everyday person. What do you say to them?
Yeah, we've also heard this, and we also feel like that this is a belief that needs to be busted as well. What we heard from providers and people with disability that we spoke with is that ILAs work for a whole lot of people. For example, we spoke with a young man who is of African background, and his family is over in Africa, and his experience in Australia is that he has bounced around a lot of systems, from youth justice to 24/7 support in a group home, but he's now living and thriving in his own individualised living arrangement. And he is supported by a team of mentors who help him solve problems when they come up. And now he is connected to his community, he's playing footy, and he's looking for a job. And that's just one example of many that people shared with us. We also know that one provider has 15 people that they're supporting through ILAs who are supported by the Public Guardian. Public Guardian, as many know, is the person that can sometimes be making decisions for people with disability if they don't have anyone else to assist them. And in those arrangements, they're often people who don't have strong support networks, but the ILAs are building that up for people. So far from being just for people who have resources, ILAs can be an active way of building the social networks for people with disability.
Yeah, and when we look at the individualised living options under the NDIS, there is that support to develop, plan, maintain, oversee, so it doesn't have to be the mum and dad. I mean, mum and dads are great, and we don't want to say that they're not an important part of this, but they don't have to do all the work. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. What we're saying is there are a number of providers across the country, and we want to see more of them who are supporting people with disability on that journey. How do they want to live? How do they want to structure their ILA? And doing that work, taking that administrative load off family members so that family members can just be family members and enjoy being with the person with disability that they have in their life.
This kind of arrangement is fantastic, but we do lots of different arrangements, don't we? And this might not be the right arrangement for everyone, right?
Yeah, thanks, George. I mean, look, we have heard that as well, and I think there are a number of things about individualised living arrangements that make them an opportunity for everyone to explore, and they are that the design process is based on the needs of the person. So a provider will work very closely with the person with disability and their family, if appropriate, to understand the needs and desires of the person with disability and design the arrangement around them. If it's somebody who has high support needs, for example, that might look like a housemate who then is supported by a team of paid support workers. And in these arrangements, there can be flexibility in what they look like. So they really are based on what the person with disability needs. And I think that's one of the keys to them, is that they can flex to what the person needs. Of course, it might be that you don't want to share your life, and that's fine. So that's also something that will come out in the process that you undertake with a provider about how you want to live, who you want to live with, and how you want your supports.
Yeah, I think it also comes down to how much active support that you need. So, you know, these informal supporters, they're not there to help you have a shower and, you know, turn you in bed every 2 hours. It's a different kind of role, which is far more informal, far more based on companionship and supporting the person in a more friendship kind of way rather than direct support. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, George. And look, but somebody with the needs you've described, someone who needs active support, can still get that in an ILA, and they can still get the companionship through their housemate. So it's just a matter of working with the provider and the person with disability to look at what you do need and whether this is an arrangement that works for you. But if it doesn't, there will be another one that does.
Fantastic. I want to go back to the report. I love the title of the report, Moving Up, Moving On. So really, really good title. The report makes a number of recommendations to the government. What changes are you hoping to achieve through this work?
Yeah, so the report that we've just released has a number of kind of recommendations for government, but to really kind of get behind ILAs and to grow them, what we've seen so far is a lack of commitment from government. So we're really calling on government to back and show strong commitment to ILAs. And we think that can happen through a number of ways. One way, one thing that we're hoping to see is a specific tax treatment for how live-in supporters are reimbursed. So I think that's really important, and that's holding back these sorts of arrangements. We're calling for immediate indexation of the arrangements and of the ILO funding stream. We also want a clearer and simpler process for people to establish these ILAs. So what we heard in the development of this report is that to get SIL funding for group homes is a much simpler and easier process than establishing an ILA. So we also think that's holding back the growth of these arrangements. And then the final thing we've called for, or one of the other things we've called for, is a regulation system that enables these arrangements to grow.
That's really interesting. I'm thinking now about the NDIS support list and how they're limiting how people can use our funding. Do you think that they're getting in the way of these kind of innovative arrangements?
Well, George, we've spoken about this quite a lot before. As you know, I'm not a fan of the prescriptive list of NDIS supports that we've currently got now. You know, I think there needs to be guardrails. So there's guidance on what NDIS funding can be used for. A prescriptive list of what's in and out, I think, does curtail innovation. It kind of drives people towards more institutional type supports, and I actually think it increases the cost pressure on the NDIS. I think when we have a proper assessment introduced and a flexible budget which the NDIA is working on at the moment, that will hopefully lead to people being able to use their funds more flexibly. I think there is lack of clarity around the issue of whether rent can be paid for live-in supporters, and there's lack of certainty around that. So our understanding is that providers can claim for the support provided by the live-in supporter. Providers can then use this funding according to the arrangements that they have with the live-in supporter, and that might be through a reimbursement, that might be through a stipend or reduced rent.
And what else do people with disability and providers need for those arrangements to be more common in Australia?
Yeah. Look, Jess talked about some of the things that we need to happen more broadly, but we think one really simple place to start for people with disability and providers is to make sure that people with disability know that they have a choice in how they live, and that group homes are not the only option. So we can start by spreading that word. And one way to spread that word is to make sure that planners and local area coordinators and others who support people with disability, such as family members, know that that's an option. But then we also need to make sure that people with disability know that they can access funding from the NDIA if they have a housing and support need to design how they want to live. And the NDIS calls this explore and design. We also know that there are a lot of providers across the country who have the skills and experience to design these arrangements and work with people with disability to do that. And we need more investment to build the number of providers who can do that and have some peer networks or other ways that people can come together and share knowledge and connect about what they know about good practice in supporting individualised living arrangements. So we want to see that kind of network grow and build the workforce so that there's good practice and good understanding that individualised living arrangements are an option.
I think that peer support and capacity building is going to be critical, and it has been critical. I know that there are a lot of people who have seen other people with these arrangements and thought, oh, that might be possible for me. And, you know, the video that we saw earlier was with Belonging Matters. They do a lot of this capacity building work. So we need to keep investing in organisations like that to support people with disability and families. I'm thinking about these live-in supporters. We're going to need a lot more than that, really. And where are we going to find them?
I think that's a good question, George. Look, I don't think this is going to happen overnight, but we need a concerted effort by the sector and by government to build the number of live-in supporters. I think we can also draw an experience from what the UK has done and also what Canada has done. So as we've sort of said previously, there's 10,000 arrangements like this in the UK with live-in supporters. And so they've managed to grow that over a number of years. And they've also got government that wants to see more of this. So they've recently backed in with an increase in funding, kind of building more live-in supporters and more of these types of arrangements. I think we also need to look at the mutual benefit that comes from these sort of arrangements. You know, Australia's in the midst of a housing crisis at the moment. I think ILAs have the potential to increase housing options for people who would be well suited to being a live-in supporter. So I think it will take time. It's not going to happen overnight, but I do think it's something that over time we can grow the number of people that want to do this and see the kind of mutual benefit of living and supporting someone with disability.
And yes, you're absolutely right. There is definitely some benefit there. Mm. And whenever I've spoken to people in these arrangements, the supporter says it's the best thing that's happened to them, and they wish that they'd heard about something like this. So I think that if we get the word out, there'll be a lot more people who want to do this, and also, you know, those other things that you mentioned earlier to encourage people to do it. Absolutely. Mm. Before we wrap up, I'd like to ask both of you this question. How can the disability community, providers and their allies, how can we work together to push for some of these changes? And what role can our listeners play in driving us towards that change?
So I think there's a lot that the disability community can do to help drive these arrangements. If I just think about the sector. I think they've got a huge role in educating educating people about these arrangements and telling people that group homes are not the only option. I think they can also put pressure on government to make sure that they're not just channeling people into group homes. They're not telling people that's the only option available for them. You know, we need more high quality providers that are willing to deliver ILAs. So we need new providers to enter the market and learn from those that are already established in providing this type of support. Planners and LACs, we need them to be educated and we need them to be connected. So they're not just offering a group homes as the only option for participants. They are telling them about a way to live and connecting them to providers that are delivering this type of support. And I think for government, we need them to act. We need them to be market stewards. We need them to get behind ILAs and say to the disability community that we want to see more of these.
Emma?
I think there's also a role, George, for every single one of us listening, for people with disability. Have a think about whether you are living the way you want to live right now. And if you're not, then tell someone, you know, because this can be part of a process of really looking at how you might be able to live, how you might be able to use your NDIS plan better, and that individualised living arrangements are an option. And for anyone else who might be listening, have a think about whether you or anyone in your network might have room in their life to invite a person with disability in. Could you or someone you know be a live-in supporter? I think there are a couple of things that people could do, as well as everything that Jess has mentioned.
Absolutely. Moving on, beyond group homes for NDIS participants. That's the name of the report, and you can check it out on the Summer Foundation website, summerfoundation.org.au. Thank you, Jess. Thank you, Anna. It's been a great conversation. Really, really hope that people can take this report and put it into action. Thanks, both of you, for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us, George.
Thanks, George. It's been great. Thank you.
That's all we have time for on today's episode of Visible and Necessary. As you know, we love your feedback, so please share your thoughts or questions in the comments section below. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay well and reasonable.